from WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The new Congress convened this week after the break following a famously productive lame duck session. Of course, much was left unfinished. We'll focus on one item that died a quiet death, too quiet in our view, given the stakes. I'm talking about the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. Last month, we spoke with Tom Devine, the director of the nonprofit Government Accountability Project, about his decades-long effort to win real, substantial legal protections for whistleblowers in the United States, whistleblowers all too often punished by their superiors, and whose only recourse is a federal kangaroo court that, since 1994, has decided for the whistleblowers only 3 times out of 210. Devine cited several jaw-dropping examples of injustice, among them the case of George Saris.
Here's a mechanic out in Kansas, blew the whistle on not doing basic maintenance on our intelligence aircraft for up to 30 years in some instances. He, again, made a difference. He got the maintenance updated. But when he went to the IG to start their process, they said, well, you've got to have some more evidence for us before we're going to act on this. He gave them the evidence. They then accused him of criminal theft of the evidence that they had demanded. And on that basis, he had a security clearance yanked and doesn't have any duties anymore.
The new Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act seemed finally poised to address this and many other injustices by extending freedom of speech where the American people most need it. But on December 22nd, after the bill passed the House unanimously, a mystery senator put what is called an anonymous hold on the bill, effectively letting it die with the end of the legislative session. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Pete Hoekstra, a lame duck Republican from Michigan, issued a missive about how the bill would help WikiLeaks. Does that have anything to do with this anonymous senator?
Well, it set things up for the anonymous senator. Because the House needed to take out provisions that Mr. Hoekstra objected to, the Senate had to repass the same legislation. It had unanimously approved the week before. It was only when there's an opportunity for secret sabotage that couldn't be exposed because we were ready to run out the legislative clock that an opponent popped up.
Would the bill have helped WikiLeaks?
The bill actually would have frustrated WikiLeaks by sabotaging the whistleblower legislation. The only game in town that's left, which doesn't involve professional suicide, is anonymous leaks to outlets like WikiLeaks.
Do you have any idea who this senator was?
We don't want to speculate, but I can say that over the last 8 years, the 4 times that the Senate has adjourned, a senior Republican senator has put a secret hold on this taxpayer reform, and we've been able to find out who it was in the following years. One was Senator Jeff Sessions, the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who is acting at the behest of the Department of Justice during the Bush administration. In 2008, it was Senator John Kyle, whose office also said they were acting at the request of the Department of Justice. And Mr. Kyle is one of the top Republican leaders in the Senate.
Does the Justice Department, do you think, oppose the bill?
The Justice Department traditionally has been opposed because they serve as counsel for the United States in lawsuits by whistleblowers that allege retaliation. And no lawyer worth his or her salt wants a fair fight. That has changed during the Obama administration. And this time, the Republican senators can't say we were doing this for the Justice Department. The Justice Department was supporting the reform.
So what would the motivation otherwise be?
Oh, it seems like there's a little bit different agenda in the back rooms than there is on the political campaign trail. This last election, we saw what's been characterized as a political revolution because the taxpayers are fed up with government waste, fraud, abuse, and deficits. And the breeding ground for all of that corruption is secrecy. And for some reason, the same party that won an election based on those themes is the one that's killing rights for people who risk everything to live them.
Daryl Issa, who is a California Republican, was a co-sponsor of the Whistleblower Protection Act, and yet at the last minute he seemed to side with Pete Hoekstra and oppose the bill for being weak on WikiLeaks.
That's very ironic because he's pledged a very ambitious oversight agenda of hearings to go after corruption in the Obama administration. And it's a lot more likely that people want to stick their necks out and testify if he would stop blocking them having rights against the inevitable retaliation that occurs if they help him.
So what becomes now of the Whistleblower Protection Act?
Well, we did earn 534 to Secret 1 mandate in the final day of Congress. The House passed it unanimously, and the Senate would have passed it again. So we don't really think that that's a defeat for our reform. It's a delay that's frustrating the democratic process.
We're going to ask our listeners to try and help us unmask the mystery senator by calling their congressional offices. If they manage to do that, what do you think the fallout would be?
That senator would have a lot of explaining to do to taxpayers who ought to be very interested about the difference between political rhetoric and reality.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Devine is the legal director of the Government Accountability Project. If you would like to help us find out who killed the bill, go to wnyc.org/blowthewhistle. There you'll find a database with the contact information of the 87 senators that were held over from the 111th congressional session. If you contact them, email us at blowthewhistle@wnyc.org and tell us what they had to say. We will update our database as the information comes into us, and maybe, just maybe, we'll smoke out the senator who deep-sixed this vital bill.
This week, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs announced that he'll step down from his post. Gibbs has worked for Barack Obama since his 2004 Senate run and was communications director for the 2008 presidential campaign. Back then, he was known for his acerbic style. The most memorable example was the back and forth with Fox News host Sean Hannity. After Hannity pressed Gibbs on Obama's relationship to William Ayers, Gibbs replied that as long as Hannity was using the logic of guilt by association, it was probably worth mentioning the anti-Semite Hannity had hosted on his show the week before.
We put Malik Shabazz on the show. I put Khalid Muhammad on my show.
Why am I not to believe that you're anti-Semitic? Why am I not to believe that everybody works for the network?
But, says New York Times political reporter Mark Leibovich, once Gibbs started working in the White House, he took a much milder approach.
Gibbs has been not as combative as he was during the campaign. There were a few memorable things. I mean, there was an episode when he told Sam Youngman of The Hill that the White House was frustrated with what Gibbs called the professional left, the liberals in the Democratic Party who were never satisfied by any Obama administration agenda. He caught a lot of flack from, predictably, the left. And it's unclear if that was a purpose pitch or not, or whether he was freelancing.
Can I just interrupt you? For those of our listeners who are not baseball aficionados, a purpose pitch is a pitch that is not only out of the strike zone, but under the batter's nose with the intention of letting the batter back off of the plate, lest the pitcher put the next one in his ear, correct?
Yeah. The other one was when Gibbs responded to a question in which he said that, yes, in fact, it was possible that the Democrats could lose control of the House of Representatives in the November elections.
I think there is no doubt that there are a lot of seats that will be up, a lot of contested seats. I think people are going to have a choice to make in the fall. But I think there's no doubt there are enough seats in play that could cause Republicans to gain control. There's no doubt about that.
And this was the summer, and he was stating an absolute fact that turned out to be correct by events. And yet he was utterly lampooned. He was like, how dare Robert Gibbs suggest that the Democrats could lose the House of Representatives? And I thought that was a wonderful abject lesson in the Michael Kinsley law of what a gaffe is in Washington, which is someone speaking honestly.
The highlight reel of Gibbs' moments with the press is it's not a necessarily long one. But to your way of thinking, that's kind of what press secretaries would like to compile, a short highlight reel, no?
Going back to baseball metaphors, in some ways, the job of a modern press secretary is akin to that of a baseball umpire, which is if you're not being noticed at all, you're probably doing a pretty good job. And I think for the most part, Robert Gibbs was well respected, certainly by the president, certainly by people at the White House, if not necessarily the press. And one of the tenets of respect in this game is not making any needless news beyond the daily message. And Robert Gibbs did not make a lot of news from the podium. I mean, he made news in that he could speak authoritatively for the president, but not in that he would misspeak any more than, you know, what you would expect from someone in an age in which everything is immediately tweeted and blogged and so forth.
I want to ask you something about that professional left remark. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that Gibbs may have observed that, but maybe deserves some of the blame. Was it the dissatisfaction among that constituency partly the fault of Gibbs and the administration for not doing a better selling job?
Look, there's been a widespread criticism of this White House, which is that it has a, quote, communications problem, that this is an administration that has legitimately accomplished a great deal. They've passed some historic legislation and yet has not, for whatever reason, been successful in promoting the good points of these accomplishments in a way that would make the American people truly understand what's gone on.
In fact, they've been on the defensive from the get-go, no?
They have absolutely been on the defensive from the get-go. I think to some degree it's unfair because, again, I don't think anyone has mastered the art of how to communicate in the environment that is today's media. I think it's telling that in the press secretary's office, in the closet, there is a flak jacket that has been passed down from every White House press secretary since Ron Nessen.
Nessen, that's Gerald Ford's press secretary.
Right. And only the acting press secretaries get to open the closet and see the flak jacket. And I think to some degree, you know, Robert Gibbs, in a very real sense, is on the front lines of the day-to-day battle of this media environment in which there's a lot of triviality and very, very short attention spans. And survival is probably the first job, and lack of embarrassment is probably the second job. And I think to some degree, Robert Gibbs comes out of this with a career and a future, and that's probably, you know, at minimum what you can hope for in a job that's so fraught with peril.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Mark Leibovich is a national political reporter for the New York Times.
Coming up, news on two old stories in which the media coverage led the audience astray.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On April 9th, 2003, a group of Iraqis, with some decisive help from the U.S. Marines, toppled a statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square in Baghdad.
They're waving their fists in the air. They're chanting death to Saddam.
Today was nothing less than a revolution.
Watching these amazing scenes of ordinary Iraqis, citizens with sledgehammers.
They rushed forward frenzied to stamp triumphantly on the broken metal body.
The edifice of the man responsible for two decades of tyranny pulled down in the center of Baghdad.
For some, this signaled the end of the Iraq War and the liberation of a jubilant people. For others, it was just a photo op orchestrated by the United States, a device to suggest victory long before the fact. Journalist Peter Maas, who was there when it all happened, suggests in the latest New Yorker that neither of these accounts captures the truth.
When one looks at Firdaus Square and what happened there, it's easy to think, oh, this was stage managed, a big photo op. More than 200 reporters were at the Palestine Hotel. This was the place in Baghdad where the foreign press was based.
The Palestine Hotel, which we should mention, was right next to Firdaus Square.
They went there because the journalists themselves were in some jeopardy from mobs, from Iraqi security forces, and also from American forces, which the day before had shelled the Palestine Hotel. So the Marines knew there were journalists there, but they weren't going there to put on a show. They were going there basically to secure that terrain.
In your article, you mentioned the idea of the strategic corporal. This is the notion that in a world of immediate global communications, the actions of even a low-ranking soldier can have immense impact.
The strategic corporal issue is fascinating because there's this gunnery sergeant named Leon Lambert who'd been in the Marines for about 16 years, and he rolls into Firdaus Square, and his first instinct is, which he blurts out over the radio system, hey, let's take down that statue. And his commander, a captain, said, no way, you know, we got to secure this place. But once Firdaus Square was secured, Lambert radios to his commander, a captain, and says, hey, you know, some Iraqis are here and they want to do something to the statue. Would you mind if I hand them a sledgehammer and a rope? And the commander says, okay, but don't use your vehicle. This triggered the whole toppling. Nobody above the rank of captain was aware of this. Lieutenant Colonel Brian McCoy emerges from the Palestine and all of a sudden sees this panorama of Iraqis with a sledgehammer and a rope,
trying to bring down this huge statue and doomed to failure.
Surrounded by cameras. And he realizes, McCoy does, that if he didn't take down the statue, then the image that was going to be broadcast across the world was of the statue that refused to yield. And the statue is a symbol now worldwide, because the press is there, of the regime of Saddam Hussein. And so for that reason, he decided to take down the statue.
Would you talk a little bit about the debacle of the American flag plastered on the statue of Saddam's face?
Again, here you have the Marine up there. What is he doing? Oh, there we have it.
Furling an American flag. Yeah.
You know, a lot of people here in America and elsewhere thought, well, this is part of the big psychological operation, put a big American flag up on top of this statue. As it turns out, this was also incredibly haphazard. There was a tank lieutenant in this battalion named Tim McLaughlin who had a flag with him. He had tried to raise it a couple of times during the invasion and had never succeeded. One time he was getting shot at, the other time a tank rolled over the flagpole that he was going to use. By the time they got to Firdaus Square, this was kind of an inside joke in the tank company, McLaughlin's flag. So when the order finally came from the commander of the battalion to take down the statue, the captain said to McLaughlin, "Get your flag up. We got a moment now for the picture you've been waiting for." And the lieutenant colonel in charge of this battalion at Firdaus Square, the first moment he became aware of it was when it was actually up on the statue. And the first thing he did was utter a profanity, and then he ordered it down.
You maintain that if there was a deception foisted on the news-consuming American people, it wasn't perpetuated by the military so much as by the media.
I think the media has to take the blame for kind of errors of commission and errors of omission.
I've always said that if they just took a wider angle on the square, you would see that this was not the spontaneous uprising that all those tight shots really close to the statue led one to believe it was.
If you panned out, which rarely, I'd say, TV cameras did while this was going on, you'd see a square that was mostly empty. And when this event was repeated over and over again, as it was, every 4.4 minutes on Fox TV afterwards that day and every 7.7 minutes by CNN, it wasn't the wide shot that showed the true context, that there was this very small crowd there. It was the tight shot that showed the very few number of very excited Iraqis who were surrounded by journalists, photographers, cameramen, inciting Iraqis and others to kind of respond to them.
The Iraqis and the Marines both felt the need to act because of the presence of the cameras.
This is really a key thing. The battalion commander gave the order to take down the statue because there were cameras there filming everything that was going on. If the cameras weren't there, there would not have been a statue being brought down that day at Firdaus Square.
You note in your article that in the case of weapons of mass destruction, for example, it was the government that created the myth and fed it to the media. But in this case, you say, the media created the victory myth and then fed it to the rest of us.
They created the victory myth by uncritically presenting this toppling of the statue as an eruption of Iraqi joy, as also kind of the end of the war. This is what the commentary was saying while the statue was going down on Fox, on CNN, repeated throughout the evening, repeated in the next day's newspapers. Statues come down. The war is over. This is victory.
How much is this the fault of the reporters and how much of their editors?
It's both, actually. And in some ways, I'd say it's more the editors, because there were journalists at Firdaus Square who were telling their editors, look, this thing that's going on with the statue, don't pay much attention to it. It's not important. There are very few Iraqis here. It's a very confusing situation. This war is not over. A reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle by the name of Robert Collier filed a report that day saying just that. And the next morning he woke up and his copy had been completely changed. And his editor told him that he had just missed the significance of this historical event. A photographer I talked with, Gary Knight, was on the phone, his sat phone, with his editor in New York while the statue was coming down. And the editor said, what are you doing talking to me? Why aren't you taking a picture of what's going on? I'm watching it on TV right now. And Knight said, look, there are very few Iraqis here. This really isn't that important. Believe me, I've been in wars all over the place. And the editor said, stop talking to me and take pictures now. Ann Garrell's NPR reporter, in a report that was done by Columbia Journalism Review, explained that when she filed her reports about what was going on at Firdaus Square, her editors told her, you're not getting it. And this was repeated across the media spectrum.
You say that the overcoverage of the statue toppling led to significant undercoverage of the war. Can you prove one led to the other?
There's a really good academic study out of George Washington University. What the authors of this study did is log the TV coverage day by day, hour by hour, during the invasion and after the invasion. And basically, right after April 9th, Fox reduced its coverage of what was going on in Iraq by about 75%. All the broadcast networks by roughly similar amounts. CNN did a better job than others. But the coverage really changed in terms of the amount and also in terms of the tone.
So what difference did it make?
If Fierdo Square had been covered the way it should have been, much more balanced, less enthusiastically, let's say, then it would have been much easier for all of us to understand that it wasn't over, that we had a really nasty fight still on our hands. But this reckoning took place much later than it should have. And in that interim, people died.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Moss is the author of Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And his article, The Toppling, produced in collaboration with ProPublica, appeared in this week's New Yorker.
This week, a lengthy British medical journal investigation came to an unequivocal conclusion.
A prominent medical journal says Dr. Wakefield's study was, in fact, an elaborate fraud. According to the report, some of the children Dr. Wakefield claimed had autism were, in fact, perfectly healthy. And some of the children he claimed got sick after being vaccinated were, in fact, sick before the vaccine.
It was just falsified data to try and draw this association between this vaccine and autism.
The primary evidence that childhood vaccinations are responsible for autism was a fraud. Case closed, right? Hardly. Because almost a year ago, we talked to Dr. Richard Horton, the editor of the highly respected British medical journal The Lancet, where the panic-inducing study was first published. Horton was on the show to assess and apologize for how pernicious his journal's decision to confer respect on the controversial study had been.
This was a system failure. We failed. I think the media failed. I think government failed. I think the scientific community failed. And we all have to very critically examine what part we played in this.
The Lancet's publication of the study stoked more than a decade of panic about the role vaccines, in particular the measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR, might play in the onset of childhood autism. It's a panic no amount of fact-checking, Lancet apologies, or scientific consensus has fully quelled. The inability or unwillingness to see the truth of vaccines and autism is the subject of Seth Mnookin's new book, The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Seth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to get this established first. Is there any scientific evidence connecting vaccines to autism, toxicity, or any statistically significant level of side effects?
No, there is not, and there never has been. I think one of the things that has made this so difficult for the public to understand is that scientists are trained never to speak in absolutes. So the fact that there has not been any evidence ever indicating a link sounds to some people like there still might be evidence that will turn up tomorrow. But there have been millions of children that have been studied, and there has been fairly definitive conclusions that there is no link between developmental disorders or autism and any type of vaccine.
And just to establish the stakes, vaccination rates have spiked downward due to the hysteria. What are the public health consequences of that?
In 2010, there were 10 children in California who died of whooping cough. There was a measles outbreak in California a couple of years ago that cost $10 million to contain. So the choice not to vaccinate has very real consequences for the public and society at large.
Okay, now let's get down to the provenance of the autism myth. Where did it begin?
Well, it's interesting. It really began with this one study that was conducted in 1998 by a doctor who actually has since had his medical license revoked, a British doctor named Andrew Wakefield. And he proposed in a paper that was published in The Lancet that there was potentially a link between the measles vaccine and gut disorders, and there was also potentially a link between gut disorders and autism. In the paper itself, they were very careful not to say that they had any evidence of a link. But when Wakefield then went in front of the press, Wakefield was much more out front about saying that there was a likely connection and that parents should not vaccinate. And immediately in the UK, you saw MMR vaccine rates plummet.
The story did take hold.
Well, what you saw immediately, starting the day after the press conference that Wakefield gave, was that the media presented this as an on the one hand, on the other hand scenario.
The New York Times used a sentence along the lines of, medicine is divided on this subject.
Exactly. And I think that the claim that medicine is divided on this is similar to the claim that scientists are divided on the issue of whether the Earth is round or flat. There are some people who believe the Earth is flat, but it's not a question about which scientists are actually divided. So as the years went on and as studies specifically regarding the safety of the MMR vaccine continued to come in, for years, you still had the coverage coming down in this sort of, who knows, we'll split the difference type of sense.
So when we talk about media culpability here, there's a number of issues. One is this sort of false balance problem. There was really no controversy at all, but there was an organized group of vaccine skeptics who absolutely dominated the coverage, which was no accident. Can you tell me how this group coalesced to have such an impact on how the stories were covered, particularly on TV?
Well, first, one thing which I think I should definitely point out is that in the very early days of this, there was not the amount of evidence indicating the safety of the MMR vaccine as there is today. Once this took off and you had a set of activists take hold of this, a lot of those activists were parents who had children who were very sick with autism or other developmental disorders. And that is a very compelling narrative for newspaper writers, for TV reporters. When journalists were faced with the question of how to frame a story, the human interest angle was clear. It was presenting it through the eyes of these parents who believe very strongly that their children had been damaged. Another thing I want to make clear is that I do not think that parents who believe this are trying to perpetrate any kind of fraud. I think that the blame, as it were, in this instance, lies with the various organs and people that perpetrated this. And that's not just the media, but it's different.
Perpetrated and proliferated, right? Because to the extent that crying parents are on Good Morning America talking about their heartbreak and its adjacency to an MMR vaccination, a lot of viewers are going to get the same ideas in their heads.
Absolutely. It's a topic Oprah featured a number of times, specifically with Jenny McCarthy, who believes that her son was given autism by a vaccine. And on the first show in which Oprah presented this, she had a long conversation with Jenny McCarthy in her studio talking about how Jenny was a mother warrior taking care of her child. And then at one point she said, of course, we asked the CDC for comment. And she proceeded to read a rote statement that the CDC had given her. And as she was reading that, you just saw a series of words appear on the screen. So literally, it was the face, the image of this mother taking care of her child contrasted with a faceless bureaucracy.
Seth, your book is nominally about vaccine hysteria, but it seems to me it's really about something a lot larger, and that's the willingness of human beings to accept as truth what there is no evidence for. There seems to be some human impulse to explain complicated or painful or unknowable things in easy terms that snugly fit into some preconceived worldview. So in the end, is this a vaccine problem we're talking about here, or is it a human problem?
I think that you got to sort of a crucial point. And it even goes beyond people being willing to believe things for which there isn't evidence. It's people willing to believe things and being very insistent about believing things for which there is evidence against it. One thing you see going on now is it's much, much easier for people to construct their information intake in a way that ensures that they don't receive any views that contradict what they already think through cable TV news, through online news sources. It creates something called an availability cascade, where the more you hear something, the more you're willing to believe it's true. You see it in politics, especially. You see it in medicine a lot, in what different cures people are willing to try out or accept, even when they've been shown to be dangerous. So I think it's a paradigm that extends really throughout society and throughout culture.
Seth, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Seth Mnookin is the author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. The book is out Tuesday.
When I did get the diagnosis, though, boom, first thing I did, Google. I put in autism, and I started my
Thank
research.
God for Google.
I'm what? Telling you.
Thank God for Google.
The University of Google is where I got my degree from.
Coming up, the 10th anniversary of On the Media.
This is On the Media. After 10 years, On the Media. 10 years. 10 years.
Support for On the Media comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The Kauffman Foundation, working to advance innovations in education and entrepreneurial success. Learn more at kauffman.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, published in the U.S. in 1885, uses the N-word, according to one librarian, 219 times. Some readers just can't get past it, says Twain scholar and Auburn University professor Alan Gribben. So in a new edition to be published by New South, he's changed the N-word to slave. This, he told CBS News, quote, enables us to set this inflammatory racial epithet aside and begin to address the greatness of Twain's works. But Craig Hotchkiss, education program manager of the Mark Twain House and Museum in Hartford, says the substitution makes no sense. Slavery had been over for two decades, but segregation and racial degradation were rising, and that replacing that word removes not only what makes the racism so palpable to modern readers, it destroys the book's potency as great historical literature and teaching tool. 5 years ago, WNYC radio rookie Verilyn Williams offered us a personal appraisal of the N-word. We'll replay that now, but be warned, you'll hear it several times in her story.
It never fails. About three times a week, I'm trying to read on the train, and a bunch of rowdy teens get on and mess with my concentration. What bothers me is not the fact that they're loud, because the train is always loud during rush hour. It's the fact that they're cursing up a storm and throwing the N-word around like it's nothing.
This nigga's always pointing it down to feed him.
My parents were raised in Sierra Leone and were stricter than a lot of Bronx parents. But growing up in my house, the N-word just wasn't used. But then I entered the real world where not everyone grew up in my house. My ex-boyfriend uses the word all the time.
My name is David. My friends call me Scrooge.
I recently came across this old interview of him I did for another story.
My shout out to the all them drunk niggas out there.
Hi, so... I was not surprised to hear him say the word, but I was shocked to hear what came next on the tape. Is it okay? Well, if you had a daughter, would you let her go out with an older nigga? Or go with a guy? There it was. I know I used to say the word from time to time, but realizing I said it on tape... That's embarrassing. To me, whether it's nigga or nigger, it represents hatred and makes me think of a person who is uneducated, lazy, and basically good for nothing. Yet, I still said it. I was in a comfort zone talking to David, and it just slipped out. And I'm not the only one who says the word without thinking.
It's a messed up word. It shouldn't be used. Shouldn't be used by nobody.
Do you use the word?
Sometimes, yeah, I ain't gonna lie.
Why do you use the word?
I don't know. You know, Just niggas using in the hood all the time, nigga. What's up? You know what I mean?
Not everyone is conflicted, though. I went to Harlem to ask people if they use the word, and most of them said they had no problem with it because they feel the meaning has changed. I was stopped by this guy trying to give me a free teeth cleaning in one of those dental vans.
Can I interview you on the N-word?
On the N-word?
Yes.
Okay, sure.
Do you use the N-word?
All the time, nigga. No, I'm sorry. I think it's just something that black people ought to be able to say, because we use it not to bring each other down, but to let each other know how far we came, where we came from, what we went through.
I was talking to my friend Dre Oba. He's the editor of the Shield magazine at my school, Hunter College. We were discussing how words can dehumanize, and he quoted a friend who used to be in the gang.
He was saying it took more energy, like when you saying, okay, I'm going to kill this nigga, like you didn't think anything about it. It was like nigga became that negative thing. He said, but when you started to think about it, he said, if I was going to say, I'm going to kill my brother, I'm going to kill that brother, they would have thought more about it.
To me, that logic is one of the reasons slavery existed in this country for so long. Black people weren't considered human beings. They were niggas, and that made it a lot easier to treat them like animals. One thing almost everyone I talked to said is that it's never acceptable for white people to use the N-word.
I think that word has no power unless you use it in a derogatory way.
I was talking to this guy near Wall Street.
I'm white, and I have no problem saying, oh, come on, you know you're my nigga, just like that. I've said it before, and I'll continue to say it. And if somebody African-American has a problem with it, they don't obviously live where I live, and they don't know who my friends are, who I date. Words can only hurt if you let them. It's cliché-ish and corny, but it's true.
Not when a word has history. I did feel way more offended hearing a white guy say the word and disregard that history. But playing devil's advocate, can I blame him if growing up he heard nigga being thrown around in the music he listened to and from his friends yelling on the subway? We can't have it both ways. Either we're honoring the history or we're not. As for me, I'm trying not to use the word at all anymore.
Verilyn Williams reported this piece in 2006 as one of WNYC's Radio Rookies, a program that teaches teenagers how to report for the radio. To learn more, go to WNYC.org. In our December 3rd show, I uttered this sentence. WikiLeaks tweeted a link to a video posted on YouTube of excerpts from a speech by President John F. Kennedy in 1961 decrying government secrecy. WikiLeaks tweeted a link to a video posted on YouTube? Would you even know what that meant a few years ago? That sentence made us realize that the 10th anniversary of this incarnation of On the Media was upon us. Actually, this very week, 10 years of mind-blowingly accelerating change, which makes sense, as computer scientist and inventor Ray Kurzweil told us in 2009.
Information technology grows exponentially, basically doubling every year. What used to fit in a building now fits in your pocket, and what fits in your pocket today will fit inside a blood cell in 25 years, and it gives you some idea of what will be feasible.
So we thought we'd round out our 10th, that is to say our 10 anniversary, by looking at 10 years of media transformation through the lens of On the Media. Why not start with Craigslist? It began to expand outside its San Francisco base in 2000, eventually becoming a global repository of free classified ads and gobbling up revenue that once flowed to newspapers. Looking back at our archive, we find a range of experts blaming the decline of the daily newspaper business on Craig Newmark.
One expert in particular.
Now Craigslist, which is free, has rendered the classified business, you know, almost irrelevant.
The only details he failed to foresee were Craigslist and the collapse of the entire business.
Craigslist pretty much killed the classified ad business. So I saw the chaos and I called it. You got a problem with that? Also, across those years, we saw the growing power of blogs, which didn't play much of a role in the cultural or political life of the nation when the decade began, but oh, baby, pretty soon they were bagging some pretty big fish, such as when blogs caught Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott saying this at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday bash
in 2002.
I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
I think what we're seeing here is the ripening of an entirely new journalistic form.
Journalist John Podoretz told us that by highlighting Lott's tribute to an erstwhile segregationist, blogs showed their ability to uncover or amplify what the mainstream media barely cover or just plain miss. Trent Lott had to leave.
As is always the case when new media start, it's the people who are willing to sacrifice their time and effort out of passion that make something viable because they want to become part of the national debate.
Each election, the power of blogs to raise hell and campaign funds increased, not to mention their ability to marshal the wisdom of the crowds to unearth truths and the foolishness of crowds to propagate lies. It was all about information tailored to particular tastes, giving rise to the dreaded echo chamber, a notion that's since become a cliché of the new media age.
But to use or abuse an avalanche of information, we need a portal. It's hard to imagine our lives without Google. Launched in 1998, by 2002, the American Dialect Society chose to Google as the most useful word of the year. 2002 also saw the birth of Google News, when algorithms replaced editors as gatekeepers and served up the world's press for free. Here's Slate's Jack Schaefer back in 2002.
Well, I think that there are a lot of news functions that are better served by machines. What Google is doing is they've found a new way to bake the cake. If you want to gather and experience news from multiplicity of sources, from 4,000 sources, and have it constantly updated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Google News is your baby.
Then Google launched Google Book Search in 2004, terrifying publishers, and Google Maps in 2005, annoying entire governments by letting the people decide what places were called and which nations ought to claim them. Washington Monthly editor John Gravois.
Google is now producing the world's most important map. That used to be something nation states did. And what's happening in all these geographic disputes is that Google's getting confused with a nation state. And not just anyone, a really important one, a powerful one. The whole time, Google is kind of shrugging and saying, we're showing as many claims as possible.
Doesn't that raise the question, what is it we want our maps to be now, if no longer a single authoritative view of the world?
It's almost like we shouldn't use the word map anymore. It's a completely different thing that are just sort of repositories of a bunch of different opinions or even conversations. That's neat. But the process of adjusting to that new norm is going to be really, really hairy.
Then along came Google Translate in 2007, crossing the language barrier, and Google Street View, allowing us to virtually traverse any street anywhere.
Enough. We can't devote the whole segment to Google. Podcasting came along in 2004, allowing people to time shift radio and enabling non-professionals to become audio stars. Actually, On the Media was the first public radio show produced for national distribution to podcast in its entirety early in 2005.
Also in 2005, YouTube, creating new media tropes and new media stars. Remember Lonely Girl?
I'm having certain issues with my parents right now, which I can't talk about, so I thought I would bore you with a metaphor instead. My parents are unable to see things from my point of view, no matter how much I try and explain it to them. I learned how to see the world from a completely different point of view when I was 4. So why is it so hard for them?
Those were heady days. And let's not forget the world-changing role cell phones have played in recent years by allowing people everywhere to capture video and then post it on YouTube, drawing the world's attention to global injustice and piano-playing cats. And, of course, the second half of this decade also saw the emergence of social media as 900-pound gorillas. Facebook, launched quietly at Harvard in 2003, now engaged in world domination, and Twitter, which played a role in Iran's Green Revolution.
Just think, when we were talking about social media back in 2003, we were musing about Friendster. Jad Abumrad, now host of WNYC's Radio Lab, did a piece for us where he talked to a guy named Jordan who was trying to shed people who'd Friendstered him.
I'm getting messages from, like, high school people that I haven't talked to in years.
There's a reason he hasn't talked to them in years. Because he doesn't like them.
I always accept friendships because I feel like it'd be too rude.
This may be one of the trade-offs in a world where everyone can access everyone. See, Jordan is a victim to what sociologists call the familiar stranger phenomenon, which is this. Often in our daily routine, we'll see the same people every day, like on the subway, and we won't say anything to them because they're strangers, and it would be strange to say anything. But if we see these same people in, say, Spain, we're like, hey, how's it going? And Friendster may be just enough of a new environment to bring out all the familiar strangers in Jordan's life, which is bringing him down.
That was so cute.
I'll tell you what's really cute, how excited we were almost exactly 10 years ago about DVDs. The DVD has penetrated the market twice as fast as the CD, almost three times faster than the VCR. Some 20 million players are predicted to be in American homes by the end of the year. The national fascination with DVDs has everything to do with what they manage to cram onto those little
DVDs
discs.
DVDs have immense storage capacity, so much so that the DVD of Terminator 2 is able to include three complete versions of the film, plus an audio commentary with 26 members of the cast and crew. Fantasia 2000 has an additional 11 hours of programming. So entranced with the technology, we were only 3 months into our jobs here when, with the help of Mike Pesca, Arun Roth, and Rex Doan, we produced a mock DVD director's commentary of George W. Bush's 2001 State of the Union address.
I know Congress had to formally invite me, and it could have been a close vote. So, Mr. Vice President, I appreciate you being here to break the tie.
We had so many more laugh lines at the top.
Right. What was it? He thanked the Supreme Court?
Right. The line was, and if the other side wins, we'll take it to the Supreme Court. And he thanks Bill Clinton for keeping the heat off of him.
And the Surgeon General or something?
No, no. It was a Surgeon General because I'm going to be doing so much butt kissing to get this thing passed. I'm going to need a lip transplant.
Funny stuff. But there's nowhere to go from there.
No, the Cheney line was the best.
Our parks are places of great natural beauty and history.
At this point, almost exactly halfway through the speech, we cut away to a montage sequence of Bush at play in the parks with walking on sunshine underneath him.
Katrina and the waves.
Exactly. George frolicking at Old Faithful, George teasing a family of bears, George twirling on a mountaintop. And we pull back, way back. It's an homage to the opening shot of Sound of Music.
Sublime. It's in the added features at the end of the disc.
DVD commentaries? What's the big deal? Didn't they always exist? Didn't Craigslist, YouTube, Facebook, and the iPhone always exist? I mean, come on. Didn't Google?
10 years is a long time. In fact, according to the Wolfram Alpha computational search engine, it's 87,600 hours.
I knew that. Happy 10th, Brooke.
Back at you, Bob.
And a happy 10th to Katya Rogers.
Who got us through it all.
That's it for this decade's show. On the Media has been produced over the last 10 years by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Megan Ryan, Mark Phillips, Tony Field, Arun Roth, Mike Pesca, Janine Price, John and Dylan Keefe, and Dean Capello. Our interns this week were Andrew Parsons and Carlin Gagliotti, with more help from Elizabeth Zagroba. And as always, the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
this moment of reflection, can I just say one thing that you do that sometimes just really drives me a little crazy?
Which no, is you can say that because there's probably only one thing.
Yeah, there's
so
only one thing.
You know, I feel confident enough that since there's only one little thing.
It's just the one little
probably
thing.
Probably it's the only thing.
You always say, so-and-so, as always, thanks very much.
Oh, yeah. That's like if they've been there more than twice.
Or even if they've only been there once before, and a couple of times I've had to cut it out because they haven't been here at all.
Well, yeah. As I always say to people, as always, I'm saying to people who have never been here before. That's it?
That's it. All you that's got? The only that's thing.
That's all you got
that's
for
it.
Me?
That's the whole thing. That's it.
It's gone.
On the Media is supported by the Dial Press, publisher of The Imperfectionists, Tom Rackman's debut novel, which follows the topsy-turvy private lives of expat staffers at a newspaper in Rome. The Imperfectionists, now in paperback. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.